Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you this fine Monday afternoon?
I am daunted by the battle of ideas, but, you know, we keep going on. KBO, keep going on.
Indeed, we're going to have a lot to talk about this week. And, of course, Maurice Ruart. Maurice, how are you?
Hello, Nick. Hello, Herman.
Excellent. Very good. Right. So let's get straight into it. And there was a story this weekend, which it's not a good story, but it's exactly what we've been warning about. And this is from, I think it was Report, originally reported it, a group of black farmers in Mpumalanga who have been hailed as role models for successful land reform are being kicked off of state-owned farms by government, according to them, because they refuse to pay bribes to corrupt state officials. 12 of the black farmers interviewed this week, including a number who have been farming for 10 years, are on the verge of losing their farms, some of which had already been advertised as for lease. One of the farmers said, "All of us have been farming the land assigned to us since at least 2010 with some leases and others caretaker grants until contracts can be concluded. But all of these lease agreements have since expired and we aren't able to renew them." This is according to a farmer called Tabani Ngomalo, who has built up a herd of 470 cattle and a flock of 220 sheep. And, I actually wrote an article about this a couple of months ago where I said property rights are not just for wealthy white men who already own property. They're for everyone, because when people are victims of the state, when they are at the state's mercy, as these farmers are, they can lose their stuff in an instant. Am I correct in my assessment, Herman?
Absolutely. And you and I, Nicholas, we visited some communal farming areas in the Gauteng area, in the Gauteng region, where...
Owned by the Ekurhuleni municipality.
Yes, that's what I couldn't exactly remember. And one thing that struck me about our time there wasn't just the dilapidation, the lack of resources, the lack of, you know, proper access. There was a profound hopelessness that just, you know, lay over the whole farm like a heat wave or just like a haze, where, you know, there were chickens there and there were the odd vegetable and so on, but people, of course, but the people, they were just there. They had no. It was just in Afrikaans, I can't think of the English word now, but in Afrikaans there's a word uitsigloos. It is, you know, you can't, it's without vision, without, you know, some look to the future. And I think really the problem on an almost psychological level is that property rights gives the individual roots in a way that nothing else can. It is such a terrible cliche to, you know, the house is where the home is and or the heart is where the home is and all those kind of things. But I do think that there is an incredible value in having, you know, just a spit of land of your own and knowing it is yours and it is home and it is familiar and it is where anyone from whatever socioeconomic demographic can just exist at no, you know, whim or will of some external force. And I think what just struck me about this specific story about the farmers kicked off their farms, essentially, a few things. Firstly, I think we should believe them. I mean, corrupt state officials, my goodness, say it isn't so. So the first thing is I think that there are facts on this side. And the second thing is it's just, it's inhumane, it's undignified of a government to reduce citizens to mere, you know, tenants and serfs who can, as long as they please the powers that be, have a little place to call their own. And just the indignity of it, the fundamental clash of you know, just it just struck me as highlighting a whole aspect of property rights that I think can't really get much attention. It's not a scientific question, but I think there's a massive psychology about being a member of a community, having roots somewhere. And that's why I think Thatcher's good old property owning democracy was such an inspiring thing for a UK, United Kingdom, starved of a kind of identity and a place in the world. And I just look at this and I just become existentially depressed by the uitzichtloosheid that we see.
I think it's also a reminder that ANC and EFF land policy will effectively reduce the number of black landowners to zero, because it will make all land tenure so flimsy as to be essentially non-existent. And of course, I think the other salt in the wound here.
I think you're wrong. It won't reduce it to zero. It will reduce it to one or two. the big leader and the big leader's best buddy.
Yes. and the other salt in the wound here is that many of the farmers who are now being threatened with eviction from these state-owned farms believe that their farms are going to be part of the 300,000 hectares that the government, I think it was last week or the week before, announced that it was going to be giving out to black farmers for rural development. So, Marius, it looks like it's a lot of shuffling of cards and empty promises from the ANC here.
Yeah, well, it's the usual old story, isn't it? I mean, none of us are surprised by this. But it also shows you how the ANC and, by extension, the EFF are probably quite terrified of, if there's a middle class, property-owning middle class in South Africa. Property rights are a cornerstone of human rights and of any democracy in any democracy in the world. And without property rights, you can forget about prosperity or actually having a sustainable democracy going forward. So, I mean, it's if you think the ANC isn't really a modern democratic political party, it's just this kind of organization that wants to hold South Africa in penury forever, then this kind of makes sense that these assaults on property rights are happening. But I mean, it also just shows you the ANC has no interest in creating sort of a property owning middle class. If they did, they would have been falling over themselves to make it as easy for these farmers to be able to get title deeds and get proper property rights and so on. I mean, we all know, we don't have to rehash this, but we know the story of David Lakhase, for example, who'd been farming for 20 years or whatever it was. And he actually had to sue the government so he could buy a farm that he'd been working on for 20 years. I mean, that's the kind of guy that the ANC should actually be lauding and saying, look, this is us, this is our land reform programs been working so well. But then, I mean,
they fought him every step of the way in that legal process. At every turn, the government opposed him.
Exactly. I mean, it's boggles the mind. But I mean, and as I say, I mean, these are the ANC is not the is not a friend of the black farmer. I mean, that much is clear. If they were, these people would have been given title deeds, and they would be given the access to this property. But instead, the ANC is fighting on this, and it's all. I mean. Ach, it's a story now as old as the hills, really. I mean, I don't think any of us are surprised that this has happened.
Exactly. And I think it exposes the central lie of the land reform debates, as it's referred to, which is that it's not about empowering black people or black farmers or anything like that. It's about enriching cronies and enriching state officials who can then act as predators, sucking out value from the economy and from hardworking South Africans of all races, whether they be white or black. Herman?
Just as a closing remark from my side on this, we don't have to look far to see the perversion of what would happen. Because practically, on a practical level, government officials, politicians will on massive scale start being, having the decision-making capacity of who gets what. And we see already in so many cases where local politicians or government officials had the capacity to, you know, make some decisions. It almost invariably ends up in some corrupt, self-enriching or crony-enriching, you know, just racket, just a blatantly corrupt perversion of what could have been successful land reform. Because I think we can say here that there are two issues here. You've got restitution and reform. You've got making sure that, you know, land what that was unjustly taken from people who can be traced, and, you know, there's a legal case to answer that the land was taken illegally. There's something there, and it's telling that in that process, you know, 97% plus of those people chose monetary compensation. But, you know, so there are processes here that we can look to understand where are the minds of South Africans at and where are the minds of the politicians at. Where South Africans got some form of justice, they chose monetary remuneration because that is actually something that you can invest into a better life. And where politicians have had the capacity to make these kind of decisions about land, it has been corrupt case after corrupt case. And just, you know, just the most absurd perversions of what property rights are supposed to mean. You have cases in the Northwest where, you know, one local politician just, you know, he was responsible for managing some nature reserve. What did he do? He used it as a place to put his cattle. You know, we don't have to wonder what South Africans' attitudes are or what government officials will do with the power that they will inevitably get.
Morris?
Yeah, I just want to say, and a black property owning middle class will probably be one of the biggest threats to ANC power. I'm just thinking an example that comes to mind is of in Ghana, where after Kwame Nkrumah came to power, he did everything he could to break the power of cocoa farmers over there, because they were guys who had property rights, they weren't reliant on the government, and they posed a real threat to his grip on the country. So, I mean, that's also one of the reasons the ANC's, like I said, they've got no interest in creating a property-owning middle class, because this will be people that won't rely on the government and will be able to, you know, vote for other parties or whatever the case is. So, I mean, yeah, like I said, like the ANC probably thinks if they do create a black property-owning middle class, it'll be bad for them, which, I mean, in the long term, it might be, but it'll be better for the country.
Indeed. And of course, we will be talking about this more this week as we've just seen the first sight of the expropriation without compensation legislation, which the government is now attempting to push through Parliament. And we will bring you an analysis of that later on in the week. Let me also say that this is very good reporting by Report, which continues to be one of the best newspapers in the country. And I think it's excellent that they're bringing a story like this to light, considering, you know, that politicians are talking so much about land reform. It's important to hear these stories. Anyway, let's go on to the next one. And that is, of course, sort of connected to this, which is that Ramaphosa has called for a joint sitting of Parliament to outline his economic plan. The sitting is planned for Thursday this week, the 15th of October. Ramaphosa has said we need to take extraordinary measures towards sustainable economic recovery. This is also going to be held a week before Tito Mboweni's medium-term budget, which Mboweni has warned will, quote, not be popular. Now, early reports of the economic recovery plan that was presented at a cabinet meeting suggest, well, they haven't had a lot of good things to say about it. City Press has reported from sources in cabinet that who described the economic plan as terrible, archaic, and disturbing. There was also some criticism laid on it by the South African Communist Party, and there were others who claimed that the thing looked like it was written by an intern, and that 95% of the items measured in the economic recovery plan have not been costed. So here's an interesting thing about this, though. With the South African Communist Party attacking it, might there actually be some good news in here, do you think, Morris? Or what do you think we should maybe expect from this economic recovery plan?
Well, I think just because the sometimes the South African Communist Party is actually fairly sensible. So just because they're attacking something doesn't mean we should necessarily support it. You know, I mean, even the when Julius Malema was still in the ANC, he was talking about we need to nationalize everything, whatever. And it was actually the ANC was pushing for nationalization of mines, while the Communist was pushing back and saying, no, that'd actually be a very bad idea. So I don't think we should just knee-jerk and say, oh, no, if the Communist Party hates it, then we must like it. And, I mean, we can probably all guess what's going to be in it. It's probably going to be the usual, you know, state-led development. There's probably going to be implementation of district command councils and provincial command councils and so on. So, I mean, look, I'm not extremely hopeful. I mean, it'll be probably the normal wish list, you know, whatever. We will have full employment by 2 years' time. You know, South Africa will be the third biggest economy by 2030 because we, you know, wish it to be so. You know, there won't be anything of doing the hard work. There'll be nothing about, you know, having to cut the size of the civil service, for example, or to there might be lip service saying, you know, rationalize SOEs, but there'll be none of the hard decisions will be made. And I'm sure there won't be anything being spoken about selling SAA or privatizing it, whatever the case is. So, like I said, I for one I'm not really holding my breath. But I think what the thing is to watch out for is Tito Mboweni's medium-term budget policy statement, because I mean, all these nice things where they clash with the real world when you start running out of money. And we're gonna have to see how bad the damage is when the finance minister talks to us in 10 days' time, whatever it is.
Right, I think that's exactly correct. But Herman, I think it was our CEO Frans Cronje has pointed out that there's a central contradiction here, which is that no matter how good the economic plan is or isn't, let's assume that you know it's got a lot of the things we want in it. It's not really. You know, it's not really possible if at the same time you're fundamentally undermining property rights, isn't it?
No, exactly. And it reminds me so much of the double speak of Ramaphosa in August last year when he was in a parliamentary session. The first 10 minutes of his speech could have been delivered by, you know, someone on the center of the political spectrum, someone from the DA, perhaps even someone from the Institute of Race Relations. For the first 10 minutes, he talked about attracting investment, making South Africa an attractive investment destination, how it is vital to jobs, or all of the, you know, the good stuff. Then, for the next hour, he spent his time saying prescribed assets must be on the table as a way to fund government policy. He said to the EFF, he agrees with them, that the government, the state, should be at the center of economic activity, that not economic activity, the economic system, that the NHI will and must happen, that expropriation without compensation is something that must happen. So it's this sort of schizophrenia where you say sensible things and then you just nuke it with the most fundamental ideologically, you know, based stupidity that we've been trying for 10 years now. And the fascinating thing is, if you actually look at the plans that have been published since July this year, they are rehashes of warmed up plans of 10, 15, 20 years ago. Nothing new. It's just this time, fellas, this time it'll really work. This time we promise it'll work. Meanwhile, you look at the last 10 years and you see a wasted decade, not because the Guptas stole tons of money, but because policy was...
that didn't help.
it, of course, didn't help. But corruption is a symptom of bad policy, not, you know, a problem that causes itself. So it's just this. I'm kind of with Marius on this. That you know the real thing will be in the medium term budget policy statement. And I pity Tito Mboweni. He's between you know a rock and an impoverished state. So it's just yeah. No, I'm almost willing to say disregard most of what Ramaphosa says in this plan. We've heard it 7,000 times before.
I think there's also something else to remind our listeners of, which is that socialism and corruption actually go hand in hand. Because when the state is at the center of the economy and when the state has extreme discretionary power to decide what resources are spent on and what you essentially do is you involve politics in every level of the political, the economic process, and that creates opportunities for corruption, because then, you know, the minister can hand out licenses to their favorite companies in exchange for bribes and that kind of thing. So actually, free market reforms, market-based economy is a way of reducing opportunities for corruption, which I think is something that people need to remember. Any final thoughts, Marius, on this topic?
But we all know, I feel like a stuck record, and most of us feel like that at the Institute. It's pretty clear what needs to be done to get the country going. And South Africa still has quite a lot going for it. We just need to unshackle the economy and start, you know, doing, pushing policies. When we implement economic policies, we should actually only have one goal. And is it, will this policy create employment? And if it does, then yes, cool, go for it. Anything else is a side issue. And if you create employment, then other things such as poverty will start going down. Inequality in the long run might start going down. But anyway, inequality in and of itself is not a problem. It's poverty which is the problem. So, but those are the things. If you start creating employment, then lots of South Africa's problems start getting solved quite quickly, actually.
Herman, final thoughts?
Yeah, I'm going to slightly disagree with Marius, actually. I think he's half right on employment, but it's productive employment because you can, you know, commandeer the whole population of South Africa into the civil service or the public service or the army or something, and it will create employment. It just won't be productive employment. So I think employment, yeah, but productive employment that can actually add value to the economic system as a whole.
Exactly. Anyway, let's move on to our final topic today. And we once again return to the story of farm murders, and particularly the murder of Brendan Horner. Last week, our CEO, Frans Cronje, talked a little bit about that and the protest that turned into a bit of a riot at Senekal. And this was, of course, protesting Brendan Horner's murder. And Ramaphosa has written a letter as part of his weekly, he writes a letter every week called From the Desk of the President. And this week's letter was referenced to Senekal and the murder of Brendan Horner. Now, I'll just read some extracts from it. It says, just over a week ago, Brendan Horner, a young farm manager in the Free State, was murdered in an appalling act of cruelty. His killing should anger and upset every one of us. He then mentions some other crimes which have shocked the country recently. He then says, if we are to succeed in tackling violent crime, particularly in rural communities, we must confront this trauma and the challenges that racial attitude and challenge the racial attitudes that prevent a united response. He then goes on to attack the idea that farm murders are a white genocide. He says that, quote, numerous studies show that the crime in farming communities is largely opportunistic. He then goes on to say, the violent protests that took place in Senekal following the arrest of the suspects in Brendan Horner's murder show us that we have not yet escaped the divisions and mistrust of our past. While anger at the senseless killing is justifiable, vigilantism is not. What happened in Senekal shows just how easily the tinderbox of race hatred can be ignited. He then goes on to suggest some reforms to solve the problem, including more collaboration between farm watch organizations and community policing forums, traditional leaders being empowered to play a greater role in farming communities and safety, investment in rural development, and some other things. So for me, this is a bit of a mixed bag. Some people have criticized this as being, just the usual sort of Ramaphosa fluff, where he says a lot of nice sounding things, but doesn't provide anything concrete. Others have criticized the fact that he immediately linked what's going on here to an apartheid narrative, which is what the ANC does all the time. But I think that Ramaphosa has actually come a long way here, considering that we started the issue of farm murders, I think it was in 2018 when he was asked in an interview if there were farm murders, and he said, no, there are none. So the fact that he's acknowledging the problem is, I think, at least a bit of progress. Herman, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you make a good point, and I think he has come far from. I mean, he's good progress from a very low bar. I mean, that's at least welcoming. But I listened to you read out those quotes, and it's probably I read the letter a few times, and what strikes me is it's galling, the parallels, I just find it incredibly distasteful and galling, where he can look. I mean, if you are going to say you're going to, as a government, boil a specific community like frogs, and you victimize that community and villainize that community over 20 years, and you allow your party and other parties and parliament and so on target that community that you yourself identified on racial grounds, and then you emasculate them to the extent that they cannot protect themselves because you've made that impossible for them. You have broken down the trust those communities might have had with the police service. You have stigmatized and villainized them as everything from rapists to land thieves. If you do all that and you then get angry about an upturned police vehicle, I think you've got some brass. Now, the rule of law is absolutely, absolutely sacrosanct. You cannot, as a protest, or as a group of angry people, you cannot attempt to lynch someone accused of a crime. The rule of law matters, not just because it is an abstract convenience. It is the basis on which we can actually seek justice. Those men, despite what you might think of them, are innocent until proven guilty and have a right to due process of the law, just like you do, were you in their position. So I'm not for one second saying that some form of undermining of the rule of law or mob justice is excusable, but it is understandable. I think it is very similar to the mob justice we see in townships, where alleged rapists and alleged criminals are severely dealt with by communities who have simply lost trust in the policing structures and the law enforcement structures that should uphold the rule of law.
Just to add to that, if one looks at our murder statistics, you'll see that an actually significant number of our murders are actually vigilante killings that are carried out in various areas around the country.
Exactly. And to me, no, there isn't a white genocide going on. That is just not true. And it's not true. And but what is going on is a police failing its citizens in the worst possible ways. There is an equivalence to be drawn here between the frustration of the agricultural community, mostly perhaps white farmers, and those township mobs who do not trust the police or the state to give them justice. Both act in undermining the rule of law. And again, it's a difference between making excuses and identifying reasons for. And I think President Ramaphosa, especially with his two remarks of boiling frogs and denying farm murders, you shouldn't be surprised if the frog actually jumps out of the water, because it is actually a myth that it will stay there. So, yes, it's typical Ramaphosa. It's fluffy. It's better than 2 years ago. At least he's no longer denying this issue. But it is galling that he dares to blame angry communities, not for, you know, their undermining of the rule of law, as should be condemned, but for failures of government to maintain some form of law and order and trust between citizen and state.
Right, I think that's the main issue here. And Maurice, I just want to get your take on it in a quick 60 seconds. But to me, the big glaring error in this is that it doesn't address the complete collapse of the capacity of SAPS to do any effective policing, especially in rural areas in the country.
Yeah, I think that is part of the issue, but I think there's also broader breakdown of the capacity within the SAPS. And I think that's and just to I just want to agree with you. I do think this is actually, for around pause the statement, this is actually not bad. And I think it's really just the that he's actually acknowledging that this is an issue. And I mean, of course, like I agree with Harriman completely. There's no white genocide going on, but you've got to ask yourself, the cruelty and torture that is often used in these attacks is something that you've got to, you know, the way, where does this come from? But we all know that violence and that, like, you know, extreme violence is not unique to farm attacks in South Africa. It's something that we've, you know, we hear horrific stories coming out of townships every weekend, or, you know, things that are happening in Mitchell's Plain, for example, and horrible things happening there too. So, and there's a broader issue in South Africa. There's, you know, there's probably some big sociological study for somebody in this, but, you know, the rates of violence and the horrible things that South Africans do to, or South Africa, or people in South Africa do to other people. I mean, it's not always South Africans doing it to others. I mean, we'll see what happens with the xenophobic attacks and so on in this country. So there's something in South Africa that makes, you know, we have these, you know, really grotesque levels of violence, and farm murders is just one of the, you know, symptoms of this as well.
Well said. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow on The Daily French Show. Have a great week, everyone.